55, the State of Ohio versus Robert L. Bates. For the appellant is Mr. Martin. Proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. Your Honor, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
This is the next round of post-release control cases that come before this court. But this one is a case where there's not a whole lot of dispute. You see, both sides, as well as the Attorney General, acknowledge that Harper and Hudson are the law. Harper and Hudson have told us that you can't come back under a void sentence doctrine and correct something that was not done correctly at the original sentencing. You have 30 days, use it or lose it. And so accordingly, the appeal in this case, which comes from the October 2018 journal entry of the trial court that put post-release control into this case through a new journalized entry, has to be vacated. Because when a sentence is imposed in 2008, 2018 is too late to correct it. And so my proposition of law, which is one of those compound sentences for which I apologize, that says the failure to include a sentence of post-release control when imposing a prison sentence must be corrected on direct appeal. If I can stop my proposition right there, that first clause is controlled by Harper and Hudson. And this court can simply sustain that portion of my proposition of law and enter judgment that says that what the trial court did in 2018 was erroneous. Now, the second part of my proposition of law, and failure to do so precludes supervision on PRC at the end of the prison sentence. Well, that's really not ripe yet. The fact is, my client's still in prison, and we don't know yet what DRC is going to do. And so from that perspective, this court can enter judgment in Mr. Bates's favor by vacating the 2018 journal entry and not go beyond that, consistent with Harper and Hudson, and we have to see what DRC is going to do down the road. And this is consistent with the fact that in both Harper and Hudson, and for that matter in Grimes, the challenge that came up after the defendant was in prison. And so you don't, and so in it's completely consistent with Harper and Hudson to simply
What do we do with revised code 2929.191, which gives specific authority to correct a entry at any time if the court failed to advise a PRC?
Well, the problem with 2929.191 is that correcting via a nunk-pro-tunk, which is, I believe, the way 191 talks about it, creates the situation where you can't have a nunk-pro-tunk unless it was done properly to begin with. And so that aspect of 191 goes out the window. But the other aspect of
It doesn't say nunk-pro-tunk, does it? It just says you can do, if a court fails to fails to provide the proper PRC notification, it says the court can prepare and issue a correction to a judgment of conviction.
The problem with a correction at that point is this: post-release control is still part of the sentence imposed. So if post-release control were not imposed the first time, then a correction after the fact is a secondary punishment, is a multiple punishment, and that would violate Fifth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment prohibition on double jeopardy in its multiple punishment aspect. And of course, that was how.
Well, but he was already put on post-release control. He just the terms of the sentencing entry didn't provide all the detail, right? That.
Well, that therein lies, I believe, the dispute. To say that he was properly put on post-release control, the trial judge told and said in open court and said in the journal entry, post-release control for 5 years. It said nothing else. And so therefore, under 2929.19b, post-release control has not included consequences. And for that reason, even if what the trial court said was enough to authorize DRC to supervise, it would not be enough to authorize DRC to sanction for a violation of that supervision. You get into the same kind of situation this court found itself in State versus Brooks, where you failed to, when the trial court fails to tell a defendant, these are the consequences if you violate community control sanctions. And this court said, well, if you don't say what those consequences are first time out, you cannot impose them. Now, with Brooks, you have a situation where it's all within one branch of government. It's within the judicial branch. With PRC, you have to cross over. You've got a separation of powers issue here. And so what I would submit to the court is this. What the trial judge did is sufficient. And I talked about this as an alternative remedy in my reply brief near the end. What the trial court did was to authorize DRC to supervise, but not to punish. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that PRC is meaningless? No, not at all. Because A, you can still have supervision. And B, if my client fails to comply with supervision, he could still be subject to the statutory provisions with respect to escape, for example, for failing to be supervised. But because the trial court did not ordain the executive to be able to impose the up to 9 month prison sanction, totaling an aggregate of not more than one half the total prison sentence imposed, DRC never received that authority.
Your client never challenged the improper. If you think it was improper, he didn't file an appeal challenging that, did he?
No, he didn't. No, and the reason why my client does not need to challenge that on appeal, the reason why it was up to the state of Ohio to challenge it on appeal, is because, quite frankly, my client would prefer not to be punished. And so we go back to that notion, and you know, that the appealing party is the party that doesn't like the status quo ante. If a trial judge does not commission DRC to punish my client is not going to be the person who raises his hand and asks the teacher for more homework.
Well, but goes to the court, I mean, of appeal. That's a little, I mean, there's all kinds of ways that people are punished by DRC, for example. It's not in the sentencing entry. They can do that. It's part of the law that they can do that. I mean why would there have to be specific authorization to punish them? I mean, you've been placed on PRC. Doesn't the statute provide the specific authorization to do that? Just like any other statute?
Well, this, just like any other statute, Your Honor, the statute imposes, for example, in murder, that the sentence will be 15 to life. All right. But just because the statute says it doesn't mean that DRC can do it until the trial court tells DRC it can do it. We saw that in State versus Henderson. The statute said 15 to life. The trial judge did not. Therefore, Henderson doesn't serve a life term. State ex rel Fraley, the statute says consecutive time on a firearm spec. Trial court didn't. This court has no problem saying, hey, if the trial court did not say it, the executive branch has no power to do it. You see, one of the things, and by the way, in Henderson, we also had the situation in 514501 is discussed in Henderson, where
with post-release control, the trial court's doing really nothing more than telling the defendant what's in the statute. The court has no discretion. The sentencing judge has no discretion about how much time PRC is going to be imposed, or even the sanctions. I mean, at the most, the court says you could, if you're violated on parole, you could come back in for half your time in my sentence. But there's really no discretion there. So, do you think it really is necessary for the court to the law to be treating the court as licensing or authorizing ODRC to impose PRC?
Yes, Your Honor, because discretion or the lack thereof does not equate to the conferring of jurisdiction. You see, there's lots of places where trial courts have their hands tied. Murder, 15 to life, there's no discretion. All right, but in Henderson, the judge said 15, and therefore DRC was not empowered to go beyond 15. See, this goes back to the separation of powers. What can the DRC do? In 514501, the statute says that, hey, if the trial court makes a mistake and he goes or she goes with a definite sentence instead of indefinite or vice versa, just go ahead and change it down there at DRC. This court said, no, that's unconstitutional. You cannot do that, because to do that is to allow the sentence, the punishment that comes from the executive, not to come from the mouth of the trial judge first. The bottom line here is that separation of powers tells us that punishment, when it comes to DRC, is in fact a situation where DRC's authority goes no further than the efficacy of the trial court's pronouncement of sentence. So, and therein lies,
Mr. Martin, are you saying that, I think you're saying that when your client gets to the end of his sentence, 5 years of post-release control have been imposed, is just that if he violates, he will not have the 9 months and then half of the sentence, et cetera. It'll only be subject to the whatever the violation is.
He will not be able to be punished in that manner. He can be supervised. He cannot be punished, because those consequences set forth in 29-29-19 have not been, and it's not just a matter of having been told to him. It's they have not been told to the DRC. That's the separation of powers.
There is no consequence then if he does a technical violation of PRC. Is that correct?
That would be correct. Much like there's no consequence in Brooks when the defendant violates community control sanctions and the judge cannot give him a prison term because the judge did not pronounce that at the time. But my client is still in that situation where if he fails to report, the state's still getting something, because if he fails to report.
What does the state get if he fails to report?
An escape violation, that's a different statute, the escape statute. That's a new felony, Your Honor. And so therefore the state gets a lot in terms of
well,
that.
I mean, if he commits any crime, he'll have to suffer the consequences. It's just that he's set up now for an escape if he decides not to report.
Well, and also he's in the situation where if he commits a new felony while on post-release control, he is still subject to the enhanced punishments for committing a felony while on post-release control, because then you come back to the trial court and then the trial court can say, I'm going to impose, in addition, because you committed this on post-release control, up to the time remaining on your PRC or 1 year, whichever is greater, because that provision would still apply. And now we don't have a separation of powers problem, because at that point we're back into the judicial branch. See, and so
Mr. Martin,
I'm sorry.
In Jordan, when this court announced that it was mandatory that all the terms of PRC be set forth, and that the failure to do so, because we only spoke through our entries, therefore negated it. In 2006, when the General Assembly then enacts this new provision in B2D, and that sentence very clearly says that the failure to enter it on the journal, a statement to that effect, does not negate, limit, or otherwise affect the mandatory period of supervision that is required under Division B2 of 296728. You don't think that that language somehow impacts or informs this decision here?
Well, it doesn't in this case, Your Honor, because unlike Harper and Hudson and Grimes, where the record reflects that the trial court did it correctly at sentencing, that is not the situation in this case. The record in this case does not reflect that the trial court did anything other than what the trial court put into the journal entry at the time. That you don't have the situation in as in Grimes and Harper and Hudson, where, quite frankly, but for a non-pro-tunk entry, in those cases, a defendant has nothing to worry about. The record in this case does not support that conclusion in this case, because that's, you know, that is not what the record has is in this particular case.
But didn't Mr. Bates agree that he was told at the time of sentencing he was going to be subject to a mandatory term of PRC?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that the record reflects, other than the fact that during a plea colloquy, he may have been told that PRC could be part of the sentence. But again, that notification, that colloquy between defendant and the court does not translate into the conferring of authority on the executive branch. And I know that the general in his amicus brief says, I've got this hypersensitive view of separation of powers. Respectfully, I don't. I would suggest to the court that all we're saying is that, executive branch, you don't have the option of filling in the blanks. Executive branch, you can do only that which you were told to do. And so, therefore, you know, until this court tells the executive branch to jump, the executive branch is not supposed to be worrying about how high. And therein lies the problem in this case. When it comes to consequences, this court never told the executive branch that you can jump through DRC. And that therein lies the fundamental distinction in between this case and the Harper and Hudson, where in those cases, the trial court did tell the DRC it could do those things. And this court goes down, I would submit, a dangerous path if it accepts the invitation of the prosecutor and the general to start saying that the executive branch can do what it needs to do in situations where it's just so clear that they would do it anyway, that it's an automatic kind of a situation. Because when you do that, then you get into the situation of Henderson is still in prison, Fraley is still serving more time on consecutive sentences. And this court has made it very clear and correctly respects and enforces, if you will, that extremely important distinction in separation of powers, that what happens to my client, what the DRC is allowed to do to my client, is what the judicial branch tells DRC it can do, no more, no less, which is why Harper and Hudson remind both sides that if you've got a problem with what the judge did, do something about it right away. In this case, the state of Ohio did not. By not doing that, they lose the ability to have DRC punish my client pursuant to 292914. Although they do not lose that ability to see my client supervised, along with the other consequences that could come if my client were to commit escape or a new offense. The court's been very patient with me. I know I've gone over, Are there any further questions?
Yes, thank you. Chief, could I ask one question?
All right.
What if the sanction, or what if the requirement on post-release control is get your GED or job related, and he fails that? Is that escape?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I was having trouble hearing you. You said one of the conditions of post-release control was what?
Get your GED or a job related, and he fails to do that. Is that escape?
That is not escape. No, escape would be the failure to report, Your Honor. That type of compliance issue would not be a would not constitute escape. That would be one of those things that falls into the, you know, to use the community control sanctions parlance, the non-technical or the technical type of violation. And that would, and so that would not be something that DRC could then turn around and sanction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Is it Mr. Zalesniker is going to go first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Frank Zalesniker. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Cuyahoga County, and I'll be representing the state of Ohio in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for the amicus in this case, Mr. Zachary Keller from the Attorney General's office. Your Honors, I'd ask this court to dismiss this instant case as having been granted as improvidently allowed, simply because the argument that Mr. Martin raises now, challenging the 2008 sentencing hearing, its failure to advise the defendant of consequences of post-release control, was not raised in the trial court, was not raised in the Court of Appeals, and it wasn't even raised in his memorandum in support of jurisdiction to this case. In fact, the fact is, this is the first time that he is raising this challenge to the 2008 sentencing hearing. And that could be clear for the fact that the transcripts of this case, the 2008 hearing, weren't even made part of the record. They're not made part of the record because in the Court of Appeals, the issue raised did not require the 2008 hearing, because that's not what was being challenged. What he was challenging was the 2018 correction of post-release control in order to comply with State versus Grimes. And
Counsel, let me ask you this. Do you agree if this sentence took place post-Harper, post-Hudson, the onus would be on the state to correct that?
Well, Hudson and Harper make that clear, that it applies to both the state and the defendant equally. As such,
an improper imposition of post-release control, you know, one that did not alert the defendant of the consequences of violating, that would be something that the state would be more interested than in the defendant in addressing on a direct appeal, right? Because res judicata applies both to the state and to the defendant.
Exactly. Res judicata applies both to the state and to the defendant. And that's exactly what this court held in Harper and Hudson. As such, when there is a void sentence an improper, an error in the imposition of post-release control, both parties have a responsibility to raise that on direct appeal.
It would make sense. It would make sense that the party that is harmed by the error would have the onus to raise that. And that's why Justice Kennedy, in her opinion, stated prosecutors, defense counsel, from now on, be on notice.
Yes, both parties clearly have a responsibility to raise any errors in post-release control. But on that same, using that same logic, both parties, if neither party raises that argument on post-release control concerning that error, neither party can come back 10 years later and challenge the imposition of post-release control. Either raise it on direct appeal or you don't. Just because
you're saying that if the court makes a mistake, an omission, and it benefits the defendant, that it is on the defendant to bring that mistake to the attention of the court so the court can correct it and give that defendant additional punishment.
What I am saying is that what the defendant can't do is come back 10 years later.
No, that's a yes or no question, you know, or answer.
Yes, and also in this case,
counsel, I heard you say yes. It is the burden on the defendant to draw to the court's attention and the state's attention that I deserve more punishment than what you've just given me.
Well, it's a burden that they have to raise any they have to raise any issues of post release control at the earliest possible time. This is exactly the purpose of res judicata, in order to encourage the finality of judgments. What they can't do is ignore it and then come back 10 years later and say, oh, by the way, this is an error. And furthermore, as for them being the aggrieved party, they weren't advised of the notices of the consequences. So the defendant would have every reason to raise that issue, to want to know about the consequences. So while the defendant does have a burden to raise any errors concerning post-release control, again, this court in Hudson and Harper made it clear that they need to bring it up at the earliest possible time. This sort of gamesmanship where they see it and then they ignore it and then they bring it up 10 years later is exactly what res judicata is meant to prevent.
Say there was no imposition of post-release control. All right.
Yes.
And there should have been. And the defendant is sentenced to 10 years in jail, prison. And we know the case law that if post-release control is not imposed, if that's not, you know, within it, it's lost. If that person is released from prison, there is no post-release control. Is that correct? You still buy that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, why not, under your theory, that defendant was required to tap the judge on the shoulder and say, excuse me, ma'am, you forgot to impose post-release control on me. Would you please do that?
I'm not saying that he was required. What I'm saying is at the time, defendant is not required to make to appeal every issue. But what they can't do is ignore the issues that they see and then raise those issues 10 years later. You have one chance to do it. And this is what the court said in Harper.
Like, and that applies to the state too. What about a sentencing error where the judge, all the parties were in agreement that the defendant was going to get 9 years for the sentence. 30 days passed and the judge forgot about that and imposed a 7-year sentence. The onus would be on the state to raise that sentencing error, right? Not the defendant.
Please, yes, give and if the time. Yes, and if the state didn't raise that error, then the state would be precluded from in the future, once the direct appeal is passed, from raising it years later.
And post-release control restrictions and consequences are all benefits that benefit the state and are restrictive of the defendant's behavior. So the onus should be, you know, post-Harper, on the state to raise those.
I've never disagreed with that. I believe that the onus is on the state. The state should raise any errors in post-release control as early as possible. And ever since this court's decision in Harper and Hudson, my office has been more than vigilant in correcting and making sure that all errors in post-release control are raised at the soonest possible time, especially in light of this court's decision in State versus Harper. Anyway, concerning this case, the challenge to the 2008 hearing, again, which is being raised by Mr. Martin right now, Mr. Bates, the appellant, it's being raised for the first time, wasn't raised in the 8th District, and it wasn't raised in his memorandum in support. Transcripts necessary of the 2008 hearing, necessary to rule on this issue, have not been made part of this record, and they haven't been made part of this record just to underscore the fact that this issue is being raised for the first time. It's not properly before this court. But again,
in the record that the state resentenced in 2018, right?
Yes, pursuant to this court's decisions in State versus Simpkins and State versus Fisher.
Okay, so that was done. Can we not take that as indicia that the first go around was less than perfect?
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying that the first go around was perfect at all, by no means. I'm not making that claim. But
what are you saying about the lack of record? How does that impact here?
Well, he's challenging. Well, the argument by the defendant is the fact that certain notifications weren't made on the record, like in open court. That transcript is not part of the record. Now, what was being fixed in 2018 was, when I was at that hearing, I recognized that the sentencing entry read post-release control is part of this sentence pursuant to 2967.28. Under that court, this court's decision in State versus Grimes, we needed to have the mandatory discretionary nature of the sentence had to be in there, the length of the sentence, and the consequences in the sentencing interest. Otherwise,
but there's no requirement in statute that those things be in the sentencing entry, is there?
I agree. I agree with that. I agree with you. They're not required.
The statute requires notification at the hearing, but it doesn't require it be in the sentencing entry.
Exactly. Yeah. But under this court's decision in Grimes, in order to make sure that like the sentencing entry complied with Grimes, I asked the court to have just to re-notify the defendant of post-release control on the record, and also to incorporate those notifications in its judgment entry. Those notifications and that hearing was proper pursuant to this court's jurisprudence at the time.
You just said you wanted the court to re-notify the defendant of the consequences, but he was not notified originally of the consequences.
I wanted to re-notify the defendant of post-release control. I didn't have at the time of the hearing, I didn't have the transcript in front of me, so I didn't know what exactly happened at the hearing. What I wanted to do was make the judgment entry statutorily compliant with Grimes, which was required at the time. And that's what happened, pursuant to State versus Fisher and State versus Simpkins. The judgment entry was—
Do you agree Grimes is still good law regarding the minimum content requirement?
I guess that's sort of like, it is good law. Like, I think it's best. I think the court should place as much of that in the judgment entry as it can. But in this case, well, the 2008 case, the 2008 hearing, it stated that post-release control was part of the sentence and directed the APA to the relevant statute, 2967.28, which was, I believe, Grimes basically also said, while it required the mandatory nature and the length of the sentence to be in the judgment entry, I believe it required them to all be in the judgment entry. I believe that Grimes also stated that so long as that the judgment entry is sufficient enough to allow the APA to know what its requirements are in executing the statute, that's sufficient to give the APA authority to place them on post-release control. And that's what at least the 2008 hearing did, judgment entry did. It stated post-release control was part of the sentence for 5 years and directed the APA to the relevant statute. I would just ask this court to, I see that my time is, I want to save some time for the amicus. I would just ask this court to either dismiss this case as having been improvidently allowed, or to, if this case wants, the court wants to look at believes that this case is properly before it, recognize that it is res judicata and it could have been raised on direct appeal pursuant to this court's decisions in State versus Harper and State versus Hudson. Thank you.
Mr. Keller, you've got a little less than 3 minutes.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, one main point and a few other points, time permitting. The main point is I want to propose the following rule that I think helps sort out some of the questions we've been asking for so far. The side that runs the risk of not appealing a sentencing mistake is the side that now wants something different from what the sentencing entry allows for. It's the entry that's the key. I think that rule shows why it was Bates in this case who bore the risk. I also think that rule matches the results and the reasoning of this court's past cases. So I do agree with Mr. Martin that all agree that Harper and the cases since sent a neutral principle under which sometimes res judicata is going to cut against the state, sometimes the defendant. The key inquiry is, what is the status quo? What is the sentencing entry allows for? And zeroing in on the sentencing entry is important for understanding the status quo, because here, there's no doubt that the sentencing entry, there's no dispute it included a 5-year term of post-release control and then cited the executive to the relevant statute. We can debate whether it could have included or been more thorough, but there's no realistic fear here that we have a executive imposed sentence versus a judicial imposed sentence. And while I think the hearing, the entry versus the hearing is the key inquiry in terms of what
counsel, let me stop you right there. Is the intent of the sentencing entry only to direct DRC, or is it to reflect the notice that the defendant is entitled to as a result of the particulars of the sentence?
I think probably both, Your Honor, but I think if we're talking about when does a separation of powers problem happen that shifts the burden to appeal onto the state, I think then we're looking at the key purpose, as this court has said, is empowering the executive. And I think the standard that you can glean from this court's cases like Watkins and Grimes is that an entry needs to provide sufficient notice to put the executive on reasonable notice of what its job is. And I think here we clearly get past that point. The entry cited the executive to the relevant statute, and it also imposed the correct, legally correct 5-year term of post-release control. I do want to correct something that I think might be getting confused, even by Mr. Bates's representation, and I'm quoting page 2 of his motion to supplement. The court told Bates that it is mandatory that he serve a period of 5 years of post-release control, which is required by statute. That statement was made even on Bates's representation of what happened at the sentencing hearing. I think that the rule I'm proposing helps this court sort out the types of mistakes that a state has to appeal. You see in Henderson and Fraley, when there's actually an affirmative misstatement in the sentencing entry about the correct legal sentence, then yeah, a state either needs to appeal or run the risk of the mistake. I do want to point out one case-specific alternative that Justice DeWine raised in one of his questions. We tend to talk about res judicata in terms of a timely appeal, but sometimes there are other mechanisms to make a timely correction, and one of those, per Singleton and what the General Assembly has provided in point 191, in the post-release control context, there is a exception to res judicata that allows any time for release for a corrective hearing and entry to happen. So even if this court is, I think it's wrong to say that the mistake here benefited the defendant. I don't think anything happened that made the entry so deficient as to not impose post-release control. But even if the court feels otherwise, as long as that .191 proceeding happened before Bates's release, I don't think we have a problem here. I just want to address one more point comparison that Bates is raising, and that's to community control, his citation of the Brooks case, and that seems to be his basis for the alternative remedy he's proposing. That's wrong, because when you look why that happens in community control is it's actually a part of the statute. If you look at 2929.15b3, a court is only allowed to impose the penalty with community control that it notified the defendant of at sentencing. The General Assembly has actually done the exact opposite thing with post-release control, though, as opposed to community control. It has gone out of its way to say that notice mistakes do not affect the operation of post-release control. So the only way we shift the burden of appeal onto the state, it's not just going to be a procedural error. Procedural rules are for the benefit of defendant. We see that in the guilty plea context with Straley. If you think your plea wasn't knowing and intelligent, you as a defendant, you need to be the one to appeal. Procedural rights are for the defendants to appeal. The only time it shifts to the state is if the entry is so deficient, either there's a substantive mistake actually in the sentencing entry, or the sentencing entry is so deficient as to not empower the executive. And I don't think we're close to that line here. We can debate. We think that bar is very low for similar reasons to one of Justice Bruner's questions, that post-release control is an automatic consequence. But the court doesn't need to go that far in this case. Here we know that the entry said 5 years of post-release control. And we already know from Harper and Hudson that minor mistakes, at least in comparisons to the Grimes model, minor mistakes in the entry aren't enough to make post-release control unenforceable. And even well before Harper and Hudson, the court said so in Watkins too.
Thank you, Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could go back to Justice DeWine's question about whether the statute requires that the consequences be journalized, I would submit to the court that Criminal Rule 32C, by virtue of the fact that it says that the sentence must be journalized, and that this is integral part of the sentence. Therefore, there is a requirement of memorialization in the journal entry by virtue of that. And when the general mentions that there could be a minor mistake in how PRC is imposed, respectfully, my client going back to prison for up to 9 months at a shot.
But Mr. Martin,
yes.
You know, you say that it comes from the requirement that the sentence be journalized, but there aren't any other context in criminal law where we say that as part of the sentence, the trial judge has to say every consequence for failing to comply with the sentence, right?
Every consequence, no, but prison consequences, yes. And here, what we're talking about is the consequence
what
of
are like,
the,
what where does that come from?
Well, Your Honor, prison consequences have to be journalized by virtue of the fact that when a judge has, you know, five counts and imposes a prison sentence on each one, even if they're concurrent, you know, each count has to have its prison sentence enunciated. And so,
or if someone's being sentenced to prison, but not if someone is violating, not if someone commits a violation of a prison term, or does, you don't have to say what the consequences are if you try to escape or you try to do something else.
Things such as escape or commission of, you know, a weapon under disability following an original conviction, those are, if you will, collateral consequences from the conviction. They do not have to be enunciated. But this issue about whether or not my client can be sent back to prison as part of the very post-release control supervision that's being imposed upon him is a direct consequence, if you will. And therefore, I would submit to the court that that is part of the sentence. And so,
The statute seems really clear that the judge is supposed to notify them of that orally, but there's no requirement to put it in the sentencing entry. Why wouldn't that scheme be, why wouldn't we just follow what the legislature said?
Your Honor, two aspects of that. First of all, with the record in this case, Mr. Bates would still prevail because there's nothing in the record to show that he was in fact advised of those things.
Well,
secondly,
but part of that's because you didn't challenge it below, right? I mean, you've kind of changed your argument. You're arguing he wasn't advised, at least in your briefs now, but you didn't make that argument below.
Well, no, wait a minute, Your Honor. Below, I briefed that this court should adopt that Justice Lanzinger's dissent from the cases where she had talked about voidable as opposed to void. So that issue was preserved in that context, number one. And then number two, the reason why that transcript was not relevant to the proceedings below was because we were still in void land at that point. I mean, that appeal is being handled at a time when, you know, we're way pre-Harper. This case gets accepted by this court pre-Harper. So at that time, that 2008 transcript was gratuitous to any proceedings that were going on in the 8th District, which is why I filed a motion to supplement in this court, which of course this court denied, and I respect this court's ruling with respect to that. So, but to go beyond that, then this is not a, so this is 9 months of my client's life at a shot, up to a half of the total sentence. And so that is not some type of minor imperfection. But to the extent that the general is saying whatever's in that journal entry applies to both sides, I would submit to the court that's consistent with what I'm saying. You can supervise, but you can't punish, because that journal entry says you can supervise. That journal entry does not say that you can punish. And for 191C, and by the way, I apologize, it is not a nunk-pro-tunk. I went back and looked at the statute, and it's C that would apply here because my client is sentenced after 191 becomes effective. This is a situation where you cannot clarify by adding. Because when you add, that's a second shot at punishment. And if the state didn't like the first shot at punishment, if the state didn't like the fact that there were no consequences at that first time, then Harper and Hudson teach us that the time to do something about that was within 30 days. In the end, that that journal entry does so many different things. It notifies the defendant, but it also does more than simply tell DRC what the law is. It tells DRC what it can do. That's what Fraley stands for. Fraley isn't saying that the journal entry told DRC this is an accurate statement of the law. The trial court had concurrent time on a firearm spec when it had to be consecutive. The journal entry wasn't a matter of reflecting the law, but the journal entry was the mandate that went to the executive branch. That was the efficacious document. That was the document that conferred authority. That was the document that told DRC, you can go this far and no further. That's what I'm asking this court to do in this case. The court's been very indulgent with its time this morning, and I thank you. If there are no further questions, I would reiterate my prayer from my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Gentlemen, we'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Thank you,
Your Honor.